Hey there, welcome to Blockhead, the Peanuts tribute podcast from a cartoonist's point of view. My name is Jeff Grogan, and I will be your host for the next few minutes to talk about Peanuts, Charles Schulz, and all things Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, and Snoopy too. So sit back and enjoy. Welcome back to Blockhead, March 2019. And the sound you hear underneath my voice is the sound of one of our three cats, Betsy Jean, Roly Poly, as I affectionately nicknamed her because of her roly poliness. she's taken up residence in what is my makeshift recording studio here. The closet upstairs, my wife's fabric closet, where she's got lots of fabric samples, and we've got some fabric up on the walls to deaden the sound, to create, you know, a professional sounding podcasting studio. But try as I might to make it professional, Betsy Jean doesn't want to allow for that, and I can't bear to ask her to leave. She's too content and too happy, and purring away, aren't you, Betsy? She's purring away down there at my feet because we have a rug on the floor, too, which is, you know, how seriously we take this. So she's pretty happy, and I'm pretty happy to have her here with me. It's lonely in the closet otherwise. What am I talking about this time? So I interviewed Will Henry of Wallace the Brave. And if you know anything about comics, comic strips, syndicated comic strips in the last couple of years, Will Henry's Wallace the Brave has just sort of hit like a lightning bolt on the GoComics.com page. And it's one of the few comics that's been picked up for syndication over the last few years, and apparently is doing well for a strip that's just starting in syndication. It's just a year now, and it's a terrific strip. It's a wonderful strip. It's funny. It's a kid's strip, but it's about, you know, a world that is distinct, unique unto itself. I think part of the thing that's interesting about Wallace is the landscape is really, really a character in the strip, and it surrounds the world that Wallace and his friends and his parents live in, and it gives it a very rich kind of feeling that I think is really distinct. And so if you haven't read it, I encourage you to seek out Wallace the Brave on the GoComics.com page, or better yet, give your newspaper a call, your local newspaper a call, and demand to see Wallace on the comics page. The more new voices we get on the syndicated comics page, the better. Sometimes I think both the newspapers and the syndicates can be a little wary of introducing new voices onto the comics page. And I think that's a shame because while... Well, here's the thing. As soon as you discontinue one strip to make room for another one, you know, you get a lot of letters to the editor complaining about the missing Mary Worth strip or whatever. And I understand that. So they just gotta, you know, give more room to the comics. Give another page to the comics. I mean, they sell the newspaper. So let's demand, let's get out there. Let's start a movement. Let more new comics on the comics page. An effort in futility, perhaps, because, you know, newspapers are struggling against the tide of digital media. But nevertheless, hey, people still enjoy a newspaper. They're still on the shelves. They still sell, maybe not in the numbers they used to sell. Maybe more comics would be a way of selling more papers. How's that for an original thought? What do you think, Betsy? Do you think that's a good idea? Betsy would like to see more comics on the page, and so would I. So, anyway, if Wallace the Brave is any indication of the potential of syndicated comics in the future, then we're in good hands. There's going to be a lot of wonderful new comics that could find an audience among newspaper readers and establish, you know, a living wage for cartoonists again, which is, you know, anybody who's tried to establish themselves on the web knows how competitive that arena is and how difficult it can be. And while I admire those who have done it and done it really successfully, for many it's a struggle and difficult to make a living wage. And it means that, you know, as Brad and I were talking in our last episode, a lot of cartoonists have to find another way to support themselves than cartooning. And that takes away from their attention to their craft and to their work, and perhaps, you know, it makes it harder for a comic strip to develop, to reach the heights, you know, that Popeye and E.C. Cigar reached over the course of 10 years, or Charles Schulz and Peanuts reached over the course of 7 years of development, you know, in those first years. I think if there was a little more willingness to experiment and a little less fear, comics could really help resuscitate the print media. I know, I'm dreaming. It's pie in the sky, but hey, you know, it's possible. I don't think you can lose by printing more comics, that's for sure. So I'd love to see new comics hit the comics page. And Betsy would too. So we want to keep Betsy happy. And that's why she's here in the studio with me today. And she's demanding her comics as well. Anyway, this is a terrific discussion with Will. Really enjoyed talking to him. It was a nice opportunity to meet a new young cartoonist and talk about his work and the development of the work. I think that you'll find it really interesting. While the first 10 minutes or so really focus on Wallace and on Will, we get into Charles Schulz and Peanuts pretty quick after that. And I think one of the things in these discussions with cartoonists is that, yeah, the conversations are going to be kind of natural, and hopefully they will develop of their own accord. As of yet, I have some questions in my head, usually, regarding the influence of Schulz's work on them. But I prefer to let the discussion sort of grow naturally, and so sometimes it takes a little while before we get into Peanuts and we get into Charles Schulz's work and its influence. But we get there, so hang in there with Will and I, and if you're waiting to hear two cartoonists talking about Charles Schulz, we do get there. So this is part one. I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed talking to Will and learning about Wallace the Brave and the influence of Charles Schulz on an entirely different generation of cartoonists, which is always great to hear and to know that Schulz's work reaches across the generational divide and the years. And part two will follow up in the next couple of weeks, just as I did with Brad's episode. So without further ado, here's Will Henry and myself in discussion. How you doing?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled to have you to talk about Wallace the Brave, which is one of the greatest strips out there right now, and talk about all things Charles Schulz. So you've got a one-year anniversary coming up with Wallace.
Is that true? Yeah, I sure do, which is, you know, it's kind of a wacky concept for me. But, yeah, March 26th is 1 year in print syndication.
1 year in print syndication. How's it going?
Dude, I love it. It's been a blast so far. It's always been a weird dream of mine to have my comics and newspapers, even as, you know, things might not be going great for newspapers. It's been a blast for me.
Well, so many questions come up when we start talking about newspapers because, yeah, obviously this is a time when newspapers are in difficulty and have been for the last 10, 15 years or so. But, sure. Hey, they're still hanging in there. I know I still pick them up. But I will tell you, it thrills me to go to the supermarket and pick up one of our local papers and find Will Henry in there among all the other great cartoons that are carried in the paper, all the venerable classic ones that, you know,
have been the legacy strips that have been there forever. It's nice to see a breath of fresh air like Wallace the Brave in on the comics page.
Dude, it thrills me too, and hearing you say that is freaking awesome.
Well,
thank you.
Well, sure. Oh, it's a beautiful strip. You don't need me to say that. Both at the book collection, I read it online most of the time, but sure. I do pick up the paper at least a couple times a week, and it translates, you know, terrific on the newspaper page as well. Even though newspapers are having difficulty, everybody seems to love the strip. It's taken off like a rocket online. But how's it doing in print? Are you picking up papers?
I am. And to be honest with you, I don't know much about the game, as I would call it. You know, I'm kind of learning as I go. But, you know, according to the company, Andrews McMillan, it had a great launch.
Not surprised.
You know, in the first few months, I picked up a ton of papers. Or, you know, it was like a rapid growth. And then it's kind of like steadied out. But it's a gradual growth, which is good. It hasn't dipped yet, which is very exciting.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't think it would. You know, we all know this is difficult to crack that market. It's difficult to take space away on the comics page from one of the legacy strips that people love. And on the other hand, I think people are excited to see something of the quality of Wallace the Brave on the page. And I think it brings more readers in.
Dude, I love this podcast already.
Well, it certainly has succeeded in the book. And the book is also about a year old, too, right? Wallace the Brave, Volume 1, if that's what we can call it.
Volume 1, the original. Yeah, the book was a really cool experience. You know, I honestly never thought I would see it in print or like in a bound book because it just it wasn't really on my mind. And when the publisher came calling looking for some material for it, I mean, again, another dream come true. You know, it was really, really neat to see it all perfectly bound with like an actual publisher's logo on it.
Yeah, instead of like
Will Henry Studios produces.
Yeah, exactly. I've been through that. It's a beautiful book. It's a great book. One of the things that I love the way the comic is reformatted, but I've always loved collections of comics. I love reading them in the paper, but just as much, I've always loved like the old Peanuts paperback collections that were around when I was a kid. And I love seeing Wallace this way, too. It's immersive. You know, you get into that world that you've created, which is a really evocative, very whimsical, lyrical kind of world. I don't know. It's not just your ordinary kid strip. There's something about the world you've created, these rolling hills, the snug harbor and the water and the life on the water that's there. Is that part of your life, too? Is that autobiographical in a way?
I bet it's hard to find a comic strip that isn't autobiographical, you know, to the author at some point. But this one, I mean, absolutely. Those characters, I didn't create them. I just kind of observed my family put them in there. And they know who they are in the strip, so I don't have to say it. they know who they are. But, yeah, I live in Southern Rhode Island, and it's a beautiful place. And, you know, there are houses on stilts, and you look out, and there's, you know, little islands. And
houses on stilts. Wow.
Oh yeah, man.
I'm landlocked, so landlocked but bound by a river. We should have our houses on stilts because it floods every now and again. Every 5 or 6 years, we get another 500-year flood.
But, yeah, right.
but really, the houses on stilts in Wallace—that's a real thing. Wow.
Oh yeah. I mean, I exaggerated a little bit, but I mean, kind of a freaky story is back in Sandy. Hurricane Sandy, the water levels rose to, you know, unprecedented heights, and you would look out to the ocean and just see houses floating in the ocean. It was the weirdest, you know, saddest thing, but you would just see like houses floating in the ocean. It was bizarre.
That's freaky scary. The year before there was another hurricane, and that's the year that we got flooded. We're bound by a small river that's behind us called the Susquehanna River. And it flooded, and it flooded bad enough that it came up to the first floor of the house, and my wife took video of it, and the place looked like it was floating down a river. I mean, it looked like a houseboat. The water rushing past, you know, it wasn't still water. It was water rushing past the house. It was freaky to see. It was
bizarre stuff.
Yeah, really scary. Water can be, it's awesome, but, you know, it can be scary, too. It's a powerful force. So you said that getting into the newspapers was always a dream for you. Now, okay, I've got to admit, I'm like, I think probably 20 years older than you or so. I'm getting up there. But for me, you know, it was natural growing up. Newspapers were a big thing. That was the media that we grew up with. In the dark ages before the internet, there was the newspaper. And so it was a dream for me and people of my generation. But it's interesting, it was also a dream for you, and you're a much younger generation than I am. So that's kind of interesting. Was that how you first encountered comics, was in the newspaper? Or how did that dream begin?
You know, I hate to say it, but appropriately, it brings me back to Peanuts.
There you go.
You know, how could it not? You know, I didn't digest Peanuts in the newspaper. You know, Garfield was another big one. It was the books, and you know, you read the books and you see it in the newspaper. But I wasn't like a devout newspaper reader where I would look for the comics every day. But I knew they were in there. It was more the books. The newspaper thing, I don't know. I did some research, and in high school I was interested in comics, and in high school, you know, 2003, mm-hmm. you know, the internet was still, you know, web comics were just starting to pop up, so yeah. I wasn't grasping the concept being like 17 and you know, mm-hmm. still worrying about girls and other, you know,
mm-hmm.
bad things. but, you know, and the more I learned, I found that, you know, the two schools of thought that, as I understood it, were, you know, you could do the webcomic and sort of, you know, be your own marketer, businessman, or you could be the syndicated comic strip where, you know, you kind of focus on the work, in my opinion, and let the syndicate do all the stuff. I mean, you got to pay them, but I think it's worth it. I've always been a, I don't know, creative side first over business side.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm the same. And so are many of our peers and colleagues, I think. That's a common pitfall, you know, among mm-hmm. us. We have the right brain stuff, the left brain stuff falls off into the future there somewhere. Somehow that genetic chip is missing and marketing chip. Although, you know, there are some out there who've turned web comics around and turned it into a nice living for themselves.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, you've got to do all that yourself.
I tried it with a previous comic, Ordinary Bill. You know, I, you know, printed the t-shirts and the books and I made the posters. And I went to Comic-Con and listened to every idiot talk about whatever they wanted to talk about that day and tried to sell stuff. And it just, you know, it drained me. And I found myself worrying more about that than producing the comic strip. And that is kind of when I said, enough of that.
Right. Ordinary Bill. Now, what's that strip about?
That was just about, it was what I was doing in college.
And oh, okay.
It was about, you know, my now wife, you know, mm-hmm. my girlfriend at the time, mm-hmm. and our cat. And it was just.
Sure.
Just beer drinking and, you know.
College
parties.
Stuff. Yeah. So when did Wallace begin?
So Wallace began, I mean, you know, obviously in syndication, like we mentioned, was about a year ago in March. But I was working with Anders McNeil for a long time, maybe 4 years.
Really?
So what was that? Maybe 2013?
Uh-huh.
2014, uh-huh. around then, you know, casually. And, I you know, 2014, I was really getting into, you know, working it. Before that, it was just a concept.
So as a concept, you mean like you'd maybe done some character sketches and you hadn't really started to flesh out the strip or the world of Wallace and all of that?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I had the couple characters. I think I did a syndication packet,
mm-hmm.
sent it off, you mm-hmm. know, waited a while, then heard that they wanted a couple more. So I did, you know, another 24, sent it out. It was a long process, probably a year of just, you
just
know,
back and forth, right?
Just back and forth. And, you know, I don't want to say doing the minimum, but, you know, not spending. Well, I spent a lot of time on it, but, you know, I wasn't going home and, you know, doing 40 pages of character design, you know.
Right, right. And then finally, last year is when it happened. Or last
yeah.
year. Was it exactly last year? I mean, it was picked up by Go Comics and begun prior to that, wasn't it? Or is it just last year?
It was, yeah. I think it ran for maybe a year and a half on Go Comics before.
Oh,
it
did. Forgive me if I'm off base here, but I get the feeling maybe there's a lot of Richard Thompson in there. Is Richard Thompson and Cul-de-sac, were they?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I hate to go on a tangent here, but this is definitely Peanuts related, because when I was developing the comic, you know, Wallace the Brave, I was working with Sheena Wolf at Andrews McMeel, and the beginning stage is probably the first 6 months of really hashing out the characters and, you know, getting the setting, getting the tone. It was definitely cul-de-sac heavy. You know, I was really getting into cul-de-sac at the time, and Richard Thompson's work is obviously phenomenal. But I feel like his, you know, his humor was definitely, or, you know, parts of it were, you know, the kids' world meets the adults' world, and the adults' world meets the kids' world, and there's a lot of, like, commentating on those two worlds back and forth.
Yeah.
And my comic strip, Wallace, was really heavy on that. You know, it was a lot of the kids were a little bit younger, and they were naive, and, you know, the parents would comment on what the kids were doing, and the kids would comment about how weird the parents were, and there was a lot of that, and I kind of felt, it was okay at the time, but I felt like it was lacking something. It was really reserved, and then, you know, for some reason, well, not for some reason, but, you know, that same year I got married. And so Andrews McMeel sent me a wedding gift of, like, a bunch of books, and one of them was a Peanuts book.
Really?
Like the and it was like the 50s and 60s.
Uh-huh.
And I remember picking it up one day and just thinking, this is the shit. This is awesome. Because, you know, growing up for me, Peanuts, it was in, like, the late 90s. You know, Schultz, his characters had penetrated my world beyond the strip, you know? So the version of Snoopy I saw, I knew. The version of Charlie Brown, I knew. Mm-hmm. All the characters had been so hashed out and had penetrated my world in you know, film, you know, merchandise, that I had, like, a preconceived notion of what I was reading. And then when I jumped back to these, like, 50s and 60s Peanuts, it blew my mind, man. It was, you know, Snoopy was on all fours, and, you know,
oh yeah,
I feel like Schultz was still trying to, like, hash out the characters. There was a rawness to it. And what I took away from Peanuts that I tried to infuse in Wallace the Brave was there was, like, this lawlessness with the children. You know, there were no adults, and there was no outside influence than these kids' world, like a Lord of the Flies kind of thing. I know it's kind of extreme for, you know, Peanuts, but it was, you know, the gang of kids with no boundaries. And I loved that. So as I developed Wallace, I found that what kind of clicked for me was having more of a kid-on-kid interaction as opposed to a kid-on-adult interaction.
Right.
And that was straight from Peanuts. I mean, obviously, there's a long list of things, but I remember that moment of thinking, like, I like how free these kids are. I mean, Calvin and Hobbes has influenced me too.
Sure.
But I feel the one thing that I didn't dig about that strip was the I felt like the kids were living in the adults' world and having to live up to that world. I mean, obviously there's fantasy, but you know, they're living in the adults' world. I find, like, Peanuts, it's the kids' world, you know? It's their world, and I wanted that in Wallace. I wanted the world to be – I wanted the kids to own it.
That's really interesting that you say that, and it's a really interesting observation. I like what you're saying there about, you know, well, on the one hand, thinking of, you know, Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, and in Lord of the Flies is kind of a frightening thought. But, you know, on the other hand, they are – I mean, that's one of the things that always appealed to me about the strip as a kid. Was the fact that there were no adults around. This was, and maybe that's what it is that reaches, you know, kids as kids and adults as adults, because what Schultz has got going on in there, he's got children who ostensibly on the surface do a lot of childlike things. You know, Lucy stares at a bug, you know, when she's little. Charlie Brown's always trying to kick the football or fly the kite. And these are, like, you know, kid things. Linus is hanging on to that security blanket. But at the same time, what's interesting is Schultz finds this place where the kids are kids, but they're also adults. They stand in for adults in a way. You know, they get involved in, we're talking about psychology, we're talking about, you know, neuroses, all of the issues that Charlie Brown faces, the unrequited love. those are adult issues, and it's really kind of interesting the way Schultz and Peanut skirt that line between the adult and the childlike. And I think in part of it's because there's no adults in the strip, visually anyway. The adults are built into these kids. And it's kind of an interesting dichotomy in a way to think about. But so I find it interesting. One of the things that I noticed, you know, while I'm reading Wallace versus reading Charlie Brown, is that is exactly that difference. Like, yes, they're both kids in a kid's world. And I really think that's a great way of describing what you're doing. I also feel like your kids, in a lot of ways, it brings me back to a lot of those things that we used to do as kids. I don't know if I feel like they behave as adults in the same way Charlie Brown's or Charlie Schultz characters do in Peanuts. Do you feel that, or is that something that you recognize, or is that off base?
No, you are on point, and I've kind of I struggled with that because I didn't want to make them too grown up. You know, again, like that Richard Thompson influence where the kids are nothing but kids. You know, there's no, there's a lot of...
Little Alice, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Schultz has some really deep issues. I mean, for kids to handle. And I don't even know if I had the maturity to handle those things. So that's why they're not in my strip.
Well, you know, it's funny. As a kid reading the strip, and I started reading the strip, I think probably anybody who listens to the podcast has heard me say it ad nauseum now, but I started reading the strip when I was like 5 years old, 1965. And it's in a lot of ways, that's how I learned to read, was reading, you know, Charlie Brown books, which in those days, it was the height of Peanuts popularity. So they're floating around the neighborhood. I don't know how they always kind of ended up in my house and somebody else's house. You'd go to somebody else's house and they'd be trading them back and forth and stuff. So they appealed to me as a kid, but they continued to appeal to me as I read them again when I was a teenager and I was an early adult, and I'm like 40 years old and I'm sitting there reading Peanuts books, and they're still appealing to me, you know?
That's the magic, man.
Yep, it is the magic. And I don't know how, you know, you're right. Schultz had a lot of issues, and he had a lot of, you know, Brad Perry, who was on last time, was talking about how Schultz had this anger inside of him, which seems to fuel that strip. And I think one of the things that's different about your strip versus Schultz is that issue too. Schultz had a lot of, I think maybe repressed anger in as Brad would say, the Minnesota way, but I don't get that anger from you. I get a very lyrical, gentle kind of love of life, a love of all of these, you know, these endeavors, this fantasy world that Wallace creates, but all of the things that also kids get into, like finding a snake in the boy's bathroom, you know. I love that little episode, and that's so typical. And it brings me right back, and I find it both nostalgic and charming and funny and in a very different way, you know. But I don't get that anger that Schultz has got.
Don't worry, I have issues. I get issues to feel some things. Don't worry.
We don't have to worry. Wallace is going to go on a long time and find his inner neuroses.
Walk about through South County or whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's funny you mentioned nostalgia because, you know, again, when I was revisiting these, you know, it was 50s, 60s Peanuts.
Aren't those great?
I felt a sense of, you know, there was nostalgia for me, which is weird because I didn't grow up in that time. You know, that's well before me, mm-hmm. but it was recognizable. And it's amazing that, you know, you could write something, you know, 70 years ago and have it still be recognizable today. It's obviously you've taken something and boiled it down to its core and, you know, simplified it in a way that is universal and timeless.
Yeah. Yeah, he does that, and it really happens. You know, I'm running this podcast, and I'm obviously a Peanuts freak, but I've been really studying how the strip develops because, you know, as cartoonists, I think it's interesting that you mentioned it. I'm like in this place too where I'm developing things, and even at my advanced age, and I go back and look at Peanuts between 50 and 57, and it's amazing the changes that happen, but it's also quite daunting because it takes 7 years before Peanuts is really solidified into Peanuts. And it's not until like 1960 or so, somewhere in there, that Snoopy's actually walking on 2 feet. You know, he always gets down on all fours at some point or another throughout the early 60s. I don't remember when it is that he finally stands up and that's it. He's not walking on 4 feet anymore. But it takes a long time. Why did I start talking about this? I forget where I got lost.
I think, the last episode you were talking to Brad Perry about how, you know, nowadays when you put a comic out there, it's got to kick immediately.
Yep.
Or,
yeah.
You know, you're kicked off the page, you know. Yep. And you think about Schultz where, you know, Peppermint Patty's a staple in that comic. When did she appear? You know, it took him how long to get that character out there?
66, 16
yeah.
years.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is sort of a bizarre concept to nowadays because, you know, I know when we released Wallace the Brave, it was pretty polished. And,
yeah, it's very, very fully cooked, you know.
You know, and it took a long time to get there, which was nice. It took, you know, 4 years of behind the curtain.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's kind of what it takes now.
Yeah, exactly. It's nice that they gave you that time. And I have to say, it is fully cooked. And one of the things, the relationships between the characters, you know, really have gelled. It's beautiful the way they play off of each other, the way you have Amelia, who is this really, you know, kind of tomboyish, if I can use that phrase.
Sure.
You know, character who's really kind of tough. And then you have Spud, who's much more like I was, you know, kind of bookish and afraid of creepy crawly things. And then you have Wallace, who is like all boy and all, you know, he's head first into stuff. And then the parents too, you know, plus, you know, you're talking about the universality of Schultz's suburban world. And yeah. I recognized my home in that. And it's interesting because the suburbs in general, you know, I don't live in the suburbs anymore, but I live well outside of them. But from what I can see driving through them, the suburbs haven't changed all that much. So there's a kind of recognizable quality there, you know, that'll always be there as long as the suburbs haven't been leveled, you know,
by
global warming or something. But when I look at Wallace, I also feel like there's a timelessness to the world that Wallace inhabits. You know, in the same way, there's a timelessness about, I mean, Schultz will always be 20th century modern America, that kind of thing. Wallace has that as well, but it also feels timeless in the sense that Snug Harbor is this beautiful, lyrical landscape that's there, that's very distinct and very unique to itself. Doesn't remind me of any place I've ever lived, but at the same time, it's both fantasy land and very real.
Yeah, you know, thank you. That's how I wanted to look. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you did. You know? So, you know, when you sit down to draw, now it's interesting. Obviously, you've got a love of pen and ink. That's what one of the things that comes across in your drawing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Are you penciling first and then inking, or are you just going for it?
You know, the first year I was penciling everything so meticulously, every little, like, you know, swoop of the wind and, you know, expression mm-hmm. of the face. I was doing it all like almost as if it was pen. And now it's a little more free. You know, I've kind of gotten to know the characters enough where I can, you know, just ink without that much pencils. And I think you mentioned Schultz was doing that with, he was just drawing the expressions and keeping it real loose to kind of let the pen do the talking.
Well, I certainly get that impression from the artist edition, which I picked up recently. And I was just bowled over, you know, by how little pencil work there was evident
in
those strips. I think by the last 10 years or so, the period that everybody calls the shaky line period, you know, later in his life when his health turned, I think by then he was just pretty much drawing it freehand. And that's just, to me, that's just amazing, you know, that, cause when I sit down to do compositions, I'm always like futzing around, you know, this stuff, I don't like the way that looks. She's got to look this way. And, you know, and Schultz was just like knocking it out all the time, with that same, you know, pen point that he used over and over and over again.
And I love it. The squiggly lines are, I mean, I know he kind of got some, did he get criticism for that, like, later on? I mean, I think it's beautiful.
I do too. And there are people who do critique it. I don't listen to those people. You know, I'm not going to have them on the show. That's right. They're barred from Blockhead. They'll never be Blockheads. So, I love it too. I love the mark and the hallmark of his hand is just so meaningful and rich, you know, you couldn't have anybody else. But one of the things that just, you know, as you were saying, one of the things you notice in the early work is there was a kind of deliberateness to his inking and his drawing.
Oh, yeah.
That becomes much more relaxed over the years.
I mean, in the 50s or, you know, his first couple years, maybe, at least what I noticed, I mean, I'm not a historian, but it looked like the line weight was a little heavier and it looked like it was a little more, not as relaxed. And then as he kind of moved into the 60s, it looked like he switched pens or something like that. But the line weight is a touch sketchier, not as thick, a little thinner. And, they both work. The guy evolved.
Yeah, exactly. He evolved and the script evolved and the characters evolved and in such a marvelous way and such a slow way, you know, it was such a natural development, you know, the way the characters developed. So that brings up a thought. So do you have favorite characters in Peanuts? And is there, any way in which that, those characters have impacted Wallace or your work in any way or the way you think about characters?
Who doesn't love Snoopy? I mean, if you don't say Snoopy, you know, you're probably some weirdo. I'm just kidding. Snoopy is great. He is my favorite, but you know who's a close second? Woodstock. I love Woodstock.
Really?
I love characters that don't speak. I don't know why. I just think it's so effective when you can get a point across with no words. I mean, obviously he had the little hash marks.
Yeah.
But Woodstock was great, and I kind of interpret. I mean, I have a, you know, all-observing seagull in my comics.
Yes, it's just, right.
I didn't develop the seagull with Woodstock in mind. It kind of just happened naturally. And then I look back, it's like, oh, this has already been done.
But I never really made that connection because the seagull is distinct enough a bird, and you know Woodstock is a fairly abstract looking bird. You know,
at least in the later years. I mean, I think I don't know if it was Woodstock or not, but the birds in the beginning were pretty detailed.
Pretty naturalistic. Well, you know, I think that he didn't include, you know, Woodstock as a character per se early on until there was some place where he said, you know, I didn't want to include the birds as regular characters until I came up with a drawing that was right, you know? And it took him a while, but I love your seagull and I didn't make that connection, but yeah, there it is, right? The seagull is there and that's Woodstock. Wow. Or it's, you know,
it's the same vein. And it was totally unintentional, but maybe it was like in my subconscious seeping out onto the comics page. I don't know.
You know, there's a thing about animals in comics, in comic strips that's, I know it's a cliche to see the talking animal or the thinking animal or animals anthropomorphized, you know, in the way Snoopy and Woodstock both kind of are, and all those little Woodstocks that travel along with Snoopy. But it's there's something about that relationship that's so important and it's so great, you know, to incorporate, to see animals incorporated, you know, in a comic like that. And maybe, who knows, maybe the seagull is going to develop a personality like Snoopy. Who knows? You never
that's
know.
That's a good idea.
Well, maybe it's not a good idea. I'll leave that to you to figure out. But so Snoopy and Woodstock. Okay.
They're good. I mean, they're obvious choices. I also like Schroeder. I mean, he's good.
Yeah, well, Schroeder's got his thing, right? Schroeder's an artist, so
yeah,
he's a musician. I get him. We all kind of get him in that way, you know. You've been talking about the 50s and 60s. So having gone back and read that, would you say, you know, I'm imagining now you grew up with what the Schultz in the 80s and 90s kind of thing. Was it around then that you were first reading Peanuts?
Yeah, well, probably like, you know, early 90s was my early Peanuts 90s. Wheelhouse.
So you go back to the 50s and 60s via this book that Andrews McMeel sent to you. And sort of it's like this was newly discovered stuff for you. Is that the way I'm reading it?
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, everybody's seen the first Charlie Brown where he walks over, you know, walks across the street. And
right. We all know that one.
We all know that one. And I don't know. Maybe it was maybe it was like teenage angst or something like that, where I was like, I don't want to read what the old farts are doing from way back
sure.
when. That doesn't affect me, but you know, as an adult, and you know, I get a little more serious about comics. I'm trying to digest a lot of stuff that I had never seen before, and that was just by happenstance that I looked it up, because you know, I've always loved Peanuts, but I've only really known the later years.
Right, right. And they're very, like, it's a very different strip in the later years. So, you know, we talked a little bit about what appealed to you in the 50s and 60s. Would you identify that as, like, you know, a favorite period now in Schultz's work? Or
yeah. I think so. I think 50s and 60s were big, in my opinion. And then I think, you know, the 90s were really good. But that was probably because I was a kid and I think about those comics as my first introduction to the characters.
Well, you know, I've gone back, again, on the podcast, I've mentioned it a bunch of times, but I'm very proud of this. I have the entire Fantagraphics collection of Peanuts books, all in hardcover, some in slipcases. And I've read all of them all the way through. So I've read 50 years of the strip. And now for me, I was living in New York in the 90s. I was reading the New York Times all the time because that was my local paper. So there's no comics in the Times. So, you know, there you are, snob me, not reading the comics. So I missed out on a lot of the 90s. And when I got to the Fantagraphics volumes on the 90s, I was really, the 80s and the 90s, really, I was blown away at, you know, how high he had maintained the quality across, you know, into those 40th and 50, you know, those fourth and fifth decades. I mean,
decades.
Amazing. It's amazing. You know, there are moments when, you know, like everybody who's going to work, you know, across 50 years, there's highs and lows, right? But he's remarkably consistent. And then there are some high points, like I think when Rerun was first introduced, I didn't really get into him very much. But when I'm reading the volumes about in the 90s and Rerun starts to become literally a visual artist, I'm really starting to get into that. And
sure.
I'm thinking, wow, he's really found a voice for Rerun that is distinct from Linus and from Lucy. And this is amazing. He's like, you know, in nearing the 50th year, and his stuff is still, you know, great. And that blows me away. So the 90s to me were kind of a revelation in the way that the 50s and 60s are a revelation to you.
I mean, I couldn't imagine having that extensive of a run. I mean, could you imagine writing comics for that long every day?
No. Well, you know, I'll never have that chance unless I live into my you know, I'm over 100. But that's pretty amazing. I can't imagine. I think we're very lucky that we've got 50 years of Peanuts to look at and to enjoy, and to really, you know, see how the development of an artist's mind over that period of time. You can see this in increments, you know, incrementally, day by day in Charles Schultz, which is really amazing. And that brings me to another question is, okay, so now it's different, you know, in web comics, you can kind of come and go, you know, you can, a lot of times you can publish two, three times a week. You can, as long as you've got your audience and you keep them informed, you know, you can come and go pretty much and set your own schedule. Okay. You're working for the man now. And, right. And you're in the newspapers every day and your audience demands that comic strip and you can't really take a break. So how is that? Are you loving it? Is it like the way that Schultz seemed to love it? It becomes a way of life. Or is it like, oh my God, you know, pressure every minute.
I'll tell you what, I couldn't do 50 years of it. I'll start by saying that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's like the pressure, you know. It's weird because, you know, it's only been in syndication for a year. So I have a lot of back stock that I've been working off of, and I'm slowly trying to get in the groove of, the schedule, you know. I'm kind of, I don't know. It's been a weird time because a week before the comic launched, my wife and I had our first kid.
Oh, hey, congratulations.
Thank you. A little baby boy. And, you know, so there's been a little combination of that, you know, trying to figure out parenthood and learn the schedule of a daily comic strip.
Yeah.
But I could get into it, man. I really dig it. And there's, I've always been a very competitive person. And this is like competing with myself to see if I have the chops to do it. And I really enjoy it. And this, like,
that sounds very Charles Schulz, I gotta tell you.
That's nice of you to say.
Yeah. Are you an ice skater also?
No.
I was wondering if ice skating was the key to success, but okay, maybe not.
If it is, I'm doomed, man. I'm like a giraffe on ice skates. Oh, God. But there's something about, hitting those deadlines that's very satisfying. I don't know why. It's just maybe my competitive, lust. And something about hitting it and trying to do your best work. You know, that's part of it, too. Nothing is worse than when I was doing my webcomic Ordinary Bill, I was trying to do 3 days a week, and there was nothing worse than putting something out there with your stamp on it that wasn't what you thought was your best quality. You just wanted to get it out for that day.
Yeah.
I don't think I've run into that problem yet with Wallace the Brave. That's my biggest concern is putting out work that I'm not totally satisfied with.
Uh-huh. Sure. It's been remarkably consistent. I mean, as I go through the website or I go through the book, there's no real lows in there. It's all pretty consistent, all pretty funny and enjoyable stuff. So, whatever you're doing right. But it is it's kind of interesting once you get into that, when you are, doing a webcomic and you're out there only 3 days a week, maybe there's still a pattern of living that you fall into when you're a cartoonist like that on a regular basis. And it is a kind of, it's a grind, but it's also kind of like a meditation, in a way, cause you're always thinking about the strip and you're working in short installments. Right. And so you come up with a beginning, a middle and an end, almost very haiku like, that's another interesting question is what drew you to the short form strip as opposed to, because, comic books are so big, and I'm wondering if you're a comic book fan. I know, Wallace's mom is a comic book fan, but I don't know if you are, but, comic books are so prevalent now. And when kids get into comics, a lot of times they're talking about superheroes and stuff like that, but you've been drawn to the short form. And how did that happen? Was that something you were always intrigued by, or did you have to choose between comic books and comic strips? Had you done comic books before, or was it always the comic strip world for you?
It's always been the comic strip world in creation. But I am a comic fan. I got a whole library behind me of some pretty sweet gems. And, my father was a big comic collector
in the
70s. So, okay. I remember going to his office and just, sitting there reading comics while he worked. I mean, that was a cool experience for me.
Sure.
But it's always been on my mind. I've always enjoyed humor, though. That has a lot to do with it. I remember being in college, and I studied sculpture in college.
Oh, okay.
At the University of Connecticut. And I remember just butting heads with the teachers because, humor was not to be taken seriously. It wasn't, you can't create fine art with humor. And that just didn't rub me the right way. I didn't like it. So, the comic strip has always been kind of my outlet for humor, besides busting my buddy's balls and all that stuff.
Wow. So that's interesting. I didn't know you you studied sculpture. That's interesting. So any sculptures around that that are in the house of Will Henry, or are they all consigned to the dustbin someplace?
Yeah, you mean my father's garage?
Oh, okay. There you go. Right. It's the only space big enough. That's the problem with sculpture, right? What was it, that old line? It was a painter who said it, but sculpture is something you back into when you're trying to look at the painting.
That's pretty good, man, because it takes up a lot of room.
Well, I studied painting, among other things, while I was in school. So whenever painters wanted to insult a sculptor, that's where they go. It's an old trope you pull out every now and again if you want to, encourage a little brawl. But
I'll remember that next time we meet.
Yeah, okay. Hey, man, I love sculpture. I'm a peaceful guy. I love sculpture. It's okay. Most sculptures are bigger than I am. So, it's interesting that you talk about humor. I mean, there are funny artists. I have to say, there are a lot of funny artists once you start to it, you know. But yeah, I can see how, you know, your instructors in school could turn you off to that because, you know, especially if they don't get your humor, or your sense of humor, or where you're coming from. I can see how that can happen. But when I was studying, you know, they turned me off comics. Like, you know, I'm doing these paintings that looked like comics, and it was a big criticism of my stuff every time I went into the classroom. You know, this looks like comic book stuff. And so then you try to beat that out of yourself because, you know, you're trying to please the teachers.
Yeah.
And, that's unfortunate, but that's changed, you know, I'm at least where I teach anyway. I said in my class, they do comics.
Okay. And only comics.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, my, senior thesis for, sculpture was me making 3D comics.
Really?
Yeah.
Fan-friggin-tastic. That's great. Your own characters or some other characters?
Just like landscapey, cartoony wall reliefs, kind of like coloring book meets comics. But it's funny how you mentioned that, you know, you took your painting and made it look like comics.
Yeah.
I took my sculptures and made it look like comics.
Yeah, it's deeply embedded in us, you know, and it's like, you can't shake it. And it's like it was embedded in Charles Schulz too, you know. Of course, he grew up in the heyday of all of those great newspaper comics, which is amazing because of the size they had to work with was just so great and so liberating. But yeah, that's all he ever wanted to be was a comic strip artist. Well, Betsy's purring her approval to that interview, or discussion rather, between myself and Will, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Remember, part two will be showing up on your podcast feed in the next couple of weeks, just as I did with the Brad Perry interview. Broke this up into two parts, and so part two will follow up pretty soon. And in the meantime, be sure to head out to your local independent bookstore and order a copy of the Wallace the Brave book, Wallace the Brave Volume 1 from Andrews McMeel Publishing. Came out last year. It's a terrific book. I really have enjoyed it. If you've never read Wallace, if Wallace isn't in your local paper, the book is a great introduction. It's really enjoyable, and it's really all ages material. So it's something that you can share with your kids, with your grandkids. It's something that you'll enjoy reading as well. If you're into comics, Wallace the Brave is sure not to disappoint. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks, and we'll talk more about comics and talk more about Charles Schulz. And in the meantime, be sure to go to jeffgrogan.com, jeffgrogan.com, to check out my own work, to see what I've been up to. I am in the middle of developing some new stuff that keeps getting pushed back. It seems like it's taken forever before it will debut publicly, but we're getting there, and keeping our fingers crossed. Just like spring is coming, eventually my new work will debut. I'm hoping to do some new things on the website too. I've got some books for sale, so check those out. My art comics, for those who are interested in alternative comics, Lookout Monsters and Fan Dancers, see I remember the name this time, are up there and for sale, and as well as Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Plastic Baby Heads from Outer Space, which is, it's a crazy strip. I don't know how it ever got on Go Comics, but I think if you're into wacky, kind of off-the-wall satire, Plastic Baby Heads might be for you. So check that out. What else do I want to try to sell you here on the podcast? It's not really about selling stuff. You know, it's really about good conversation. And next time we'll meet up with Will again and continue this good conversation. And hey, it's March. What better way to celebrate Charles Schulz and Peanuts than to go fly a kite and make sure you avoid the kite-eating trees.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.